Hi, everybody. My name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic.
Karen.
So we're going to pick up where we were at last week. Beth wasn't here, and we missed you.
Aww.
And Sandy sat in for you and did a great job. Thanks again, Sandy. Appreciate that. And I'm glad to be here. Crazy week, and it's just nice just to sit and to be and be present and be in the moment and be where we are in the book.
Mm.
Self-centeredness, how about that?
So just to catch up, we've already covered, so we started this workshop with step two because the whole kind of gist of this time through the book for us is really to how to lean in, right? Lean in from your present position into how to get to the next level. Whether it's your first time going through the work or it's your 18th time going through the work, there's always room for us to grow spiritually. So then we went back and we kind of looked over powerlessness in its many forms. And then Karen started the third step last week. I'm going to back up just one paragraph because it kind of, it's a continuation of the paragraph before, and it says, what usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think that life doesn't treat him right.
Page 61.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Everybody. First full paragraph. He decides to exert himself more, right? So here we are. We've been talking a lot about needed power, right? I don't have the power, right? Did we cover glorified morals and values and philosophical, right? We have all these great plans of being consistent and being awesome, and then we just don't have the power to carry it out. So here it is when we talk about there's two different modes of living for us. We're either managing or we're powerless and we're responding. So there's reacting and there's responding, right? So he reacts and decides to manage more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, whichever one didn't work last time. As the case may be, right? Still, the play does not suit him, admitting he may be somewhat at fault. Like, all right, maybe I wasn't the nicest in this situation. I'm totally sure that guy was a total jerk. He becomes a total jerk. He becomes angry, indignant, and self-pitying. And I can tell you that for me, the number one reason that I get mad is self-pity. I love making people feel sorry for me. I refuse to feel sorry for myself, so I'm the master manipulator of making all of you feel bad for me. I mean, literally, you can give me any situation, I can make you feel so bad for me because my life is so hard, and I carry through. My first sponsor used to call it a Christ complex. Not good. Cass is awesome. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind, right? Am I not always trying to get, I'm doing this for you so that you will X, Y, and Z, you know? And it can be direct or indirect, but the self-seeking, I will never forget when I became, the blinders were like torn off of me with self-seeking behavior. And I realized that it wasn't always, I'll be nice to you and then you'll give me money. Or I'll be nice to you and you'll let me come to your party. It was, I'll be nice to you and then you'll tell everybody how nice I am. Hmm. Right? I'm awesome.
So a lot of manipulation.
I am, yes. So, right. Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Right? That word manage, that's a four-letter word for us. Is it not evident, and this blows my frickin' mind, is it not evident to everybody else that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each one of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And why is that? Because there's no truth. Because there's no honesty. You know, I screw up on a regular basis. I'm super flawed. And I make mistakes all the time. So I made a mistake last week at work where I mean, it was to my mentor of all things, too, man. Talk about embarrassing. And I called the wrong person, and I asked them to do the wrong thing. And then, you know, my mentor called my boss and was like, what the F? And, you know, as soon as I realized it, I didn't know any of that happened. As soon as I realized it, I immediately called her, left a message, and said, listen, I'm really sorry for what I did. You know, I don't know what happened. I was, like, kind of running through my day, which is also another problem. And I made the wrong phone call, and I really want to apologize to you. And then I texted my boss and the person that runs the account, and I said, I screwed up today, this is what I did, blah, 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 blah. But they know me to be honest. They know me to have my motives are to do my job. And so it wasn't that big of a deal. But and raise your hand if you can relate to this. You know you made a mistake back when you were drinking. You know you made a mistake, and you actually call and tell the truth for, like, the first time, and you can't remember how long, and nobody believes you.
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Because...
And then you're like, how can you not know that I tell the truth?
But I'm actually telling the truth this time.
Yeah.
My daughter says that to me, my 10-year-old daughter. She goes, but I'm telling the truth this time. And I'm like...
This time.
And I'm like... Mm. And then sometimes even then, she's not telling the truth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to be 10 again. Our actor, we are self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. We are like the retired businessman who lulls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining about the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would behave. Right? Again, it's always going to go back to, y'all would just do what I'm telling you to do, this would be so much better than it is. And it sucks because of everybody but me. So the next full paragraph, selfish and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Right now, when we think about step 6 and 7, when we make that list of character defects and we get humbly ask him to remove it, we ask him to remove it root and branch. What we're really asking is to be cleared of selfishness, self-centered, and self-seeking motives. It's really what makes us tick. When we step out of the center of the universe and we put God in, we admit to ourselves and everybody else that we don't know what's going on. And so my job is to just respond, like, in the best way that I can in this moment. But right now in step 3, that's what we're shooting for. Right now, when we're standing at step 3, no matter how many times you've been through the work, we're managing, right? We talked about it in step 2, where we are agnostic in certain areas of our lives. We are managing certain areas of our lives where we refuse to allow God in out of fear of losing something we have or not getting something we want. So here we stand at the beginning of step 3 going, self-centeredness is really the root of the trouble, right? Because it's all about me. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they actually hurt us, seemingly without provocation, right?
What did I do to deserve that?
I love those noises. Those are my favorite noises. seemingly without provocation, but invariably we find at some point in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. I can tell you that now, if I have contact with somebody in my life who knows me, who isn't like, oh, Beth, it's so good to see you, like, my first reaction is, what did I do? And I don't even let it go anymore. Are we good? I don't just call it right out. Are we good? Did I do something? I'm sure I did something. Please know that I'm totally stupid and have blinders on to my behavior. And I love you, and I'm feeling a sense of distance. Man, just open that stuff right up. I don't have time to be wondering what I did. I mean, let's face it, my actual next heavy inventory isn't for like 3 more years. And I'm not going
to. And a lot of times, too, when you're trying to figure out what you did, you're putting into perceptions of what other people think and how they're reacting, and we just don't know that. Again, putting ourselves in the middle, being self-centered,
and starting to manage the situation immediately.
Trying to manage, and it's exhausting. Oh my God, it's so exhausting.
Trust me, it's hard to be vulnerable. It's scary to be vulnerable. But the amount of energy you'll have left over at the end of the day if you just open up the conversation and go, can we talk? it's going to give you the level of connection with your God that's necessary to keep you free. But if we continuously shy away from these conversations, it is ultimately what starts to cloud the connection, the only connection we have to live the life that we get to live. But here we are at the beginning. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Every single one of them. Every single one of them. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must, there's a must, be rid of the selfishness we muster. It kills us, and God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of, without his aid, getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had more, oh, here it is.
There you go.
There it is. See? I always know around where we are in the book, but I don't know where this stuff actually is. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. The needed power isn't there. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our willpower. This is not a situation for fake it till you make it. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God because it didn't work. And if you're not convinced that the areas of your life where you don't allow God to come in are worse off because of it, then you're not ready to take the third step. So for those of us, I think most of us in here have been through the work at least once. Usually when I have to go through like a mini run through the steps, it's usually around an area of my life. You know, the last area of my life that I thoroughly inventoried was my job. And I can tell you that on the back end of that, I'm finally, for the first time, and I'm 45, I'm actually having a God experience through my job. To the point where, you know, the national director's like, oh my God, Beth, your numbers are so great. What'd you do? And the best I can come up with is I showed up. Because I don't really know what's going on. We had to have God's work. Right. So I love this. Next, we decided that hereafter in the drama of life, God is going to be our director. He's the principal, and we are his agents. I walked around like for 2 years, a couple, you remember this? I walked around going, I'm an agent of God.
Yeah, I remember when you told me that, and I was like, well, what does that mean? Like, I write it down.
Right? He is the father. We are the children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass from. So anybody that doesn't understand architecture, neither do I. I looked this stuff up, and I'm pretty sure Dave Palmer had something to do with it, or Schroeder. The keystone, think about a stone arch, right? And it's really funny. Now that I go over this, you'll start seeing stone arches everywhere. So think of any doorway that's round, that's made out of stone. The keystone is literally the one in the center, and it's usually shaped differently than all the other stones. Yeah. That is the only stone that holds up the entire structure. So what we're saying here is he's the principal, and we're the agent. He's the father. We're the children. This is a simple idea that is literally going to hold up this entire archway, that we get to pass through and dump our selfishness and we get to be free. It has been such an incredible experience because, and I think the only reason I'm successful in a 12-step program is because God actually does all the work. I'm way too lazy to be doing this stuff. God does all the work, right? So I can't even tell you how much more time I got in my day when selfishness, self-centeredness, and self-seeking were taken from me on a majority of the level. Definitely do not mess with me in the circle in Westfield if you're in the wrong lane.
No God in that circle?
No God in that circle. I will let you hit me if you try to merge into that lane, man.
So, you know, Beth's talking about, and you know, that's a third step decision that you're talking about right there. Mm-hmm. Am I ready? And, you know, the thing that I find so exciting about being at this place is that what I used to think when I was the director and all full of that self-centeredness is that I had to orchestrate all of you for me to be happy, which no wonder I was exhausted. Everything had to be in place. Everybody had to be doing what I needed them to do. Well, of course, I mean, we can't do that. So, you know, misery and heartache comes in over and over and over again. Well, when I flip that, and the only person I have to change is me instead of this entire room to be happy. And I have a God that's willing to change me. I mean, when she says that this is so simple, you know, wow.
I know. We don't like
mind
simple.
Blown.
You can't manipulate simple.
I know. I've tried.
I know.
I have tried.
So then we're going to get into the third step promises. On the top of 63, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. Followed. I can read. We had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. And again, like, I don't know if it's this workshop or the other workshop that I've been... This is not an unconditional program. This is not a program where you can take what you want and you can leave the rest. This is a suggested program of recovery. There are hundreds of words in this book that give credence, depth, and weight to the fact that it's conditional. We passed one over here, and now we're hitting another one, right? If. The word if means it's conditional. We kept close to him and performed his work well, right? So, and it all goes to the whole statement that we gloss over, half measures availed us nothing, 90% availed us nothing. If you're not giving it everything you have, then you get nothing. I don't know why that is. I think it's kind of stupid, but I can tell you it's true. I mean,
it's another form of like manipulation. I'm going to pick and choose what I want. I'm going to be agnostic in certain areas. God can work here, but not here. At least that's how it plays out in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I need him in some things, but I've got this one covered.
Right.
And I mean, I'm either letting God run the show or I'm not. There's no half measure on that one.
So having said that, I will also say, because I hear this all the time, like, oh, I haven't been sober for all these years because I never put this on my inventory. Please don't beat yourselves up like that. It's just, it's not worth it, and it's not true. Bring all you have today to your process, and God will meet you where you're at. And as you go through and time reveals more things, you will need to continue to honestly subject yourself to this process to continue to grow, hence leaning in with current experience. So please don't beat yourselves up, because then I will have to beat you up.
She likes that.
I do. He provided what we needed, and we kept it right. So established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs, and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. I love getting to be like that today.
Mm-hmm.
As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, still blows my mind. As we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. What a gift. All we have to do in this step is make a decision to walk through the arch, and we get peace of mind. We get to respond. We actually get the gift of starting to respond instead of react. Does that mean that we've hit a plateau and we're good forever? We're never going to be a jerk ever again? I can definitely tell you in that traffic circle, man. Oh. We were reborn. So here we have the third step prayer, which is on page 63. It is the second full paragraph. One of the exercises that I do is I have the girls that I take through the work rewrite the third step prayer to better suit them. This is their, and I think, so my sponsor had me do it, and it's gotten deeper over the years for me, because this is my process with God. This step process is so that I can build a relationship with my creator, not Bill's creator. And I'm supposed to be having a genuine experience, my genuine experience, right? Each one of us do the same work and have completely different experiences. So we go through and we rewrite the third step prayer. But as it reads in the book, many of us said to our Maker as we understand him, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And then I think it's totally alcoholic that then it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready and that we could at last abandon ourselves to him. So in visual, what that looks like is me walking up to God and turning my back and leaving myself there and walking away. Think about what the word abandon means. That's it. Not mine. No responsibility. Nothing. Abandon. Think about an abandoned child, right? They have the firehouse law or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. You walk up to the firehouse and you leave that child with nothing and never see it again. Abandon. I need to do that with myself to my God. Does that mean I get on my knees and that's exactly how I felt? No, not the first time. But the first time I did this, I got down on my knees and had absolutely no concept of the word abandon, said the prayer, got up and started writing my inventory because that's what I was told to do. But as we grow, right, we lean into this process and what it really means to us on a deeper level each time we go in, I need to abandon what I think I am. I need to abandon what I think I should be or what I could be or all of my ideas of self. I need to abandon those and let God be in charge of it. Next, it doesn't say we wait. It says we launched. So we're going to go over, hopefully, we got a half hour. We might be able to run through all three of the inventories. We launched out on a course of vigorous action. The first step of which was a house cleaning. And this is step four, right? How much do we want to go into detail? And how much do we want to do experience?
Ask these guys.
How much do you want black and white? And how much do you, would you rather have experience?
Experience.
I fucking hate writing inventory.
You just hate writing.
I just hate doing anything. I was not pleased to do my first inventory. So my sponsor, it's a four-column inventory. And any inventory that I talk about is fundamentally a four-column inventory. But for those people that can sometimes get very protective of their format of the four column inventory, I'd just take a chill pill. It's going to be okay. My first sponsor takes the four columns and busts them out, I think, to nine.
Really?
Didn't I give you these sheets?
No.
I'm pretty sure I gave you these sheets. Yeah, you came to me.
Oh, I did that inventory. On 6. I did that later. Okay.
So.
Oh, yeah, I got the sheets.
Yeah.
We got the sheets.
The sheets. They're pretty awesome, actually. They actually make it easier to do four-column inventory, but it's more writing, which is so much fun. So the first column is the person. The second column is the resentment. The way I was taught was the more specific you are with the resentment, the easier it is to see your part and get through the entire thing. So Susie is a jerk, isn't going to help. You're not going to get so far there because, let's face it, Susie actually is a jerk, so that's not going to help you.
And for me, that part was so easy because it was like, make a list of, you know, everybody in your life, mm-hmm. and if you draw a blank on that, just like, who do you complain about? Well, there was a long list. Okay, so who do I complain about, and what do they piss me off? I mean, this was a place where I didn't have to screen, I didn't have to justify, I didn't have to explain to you. I could just say, you know, things that I had never said. I mean, you know, like my sister, who, you know, we've been best friends our whole lives. And, okay, so let's get honest about this. And this is the place that I can write it. And, you know, raised Catholic, I'm always thinking lightning bolts are going to come down and get me. And just saying things like, you know, she always, she was the perfect one. And my dad loved her more. And I always felt I came in second. And she always had to save me. And so I was the, you know, problem child. And she was perfect. And all these things like for years and years that I thought in my head, but I never shared with anybody. And I started writing and I wrote. Beth could tell you, I mean, my notebook was like pages stapled onto pages. They kept opening and opening and opening.
They really did. I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So the more specific I can be with the resentment, and the way that I do the process is I sit for a week, 5 to 15 minutes a day, and I just get quiet and I write any name that comes to my mind, whether it's the mailman, whether it's my husband, everybody that I live with in my house has to be on that because they live there, therefore I have resentments against them. And any name over that week that comes, I just don't judge it. And that takes some practice. It took me a couple of inventories to actually just allow the pen to write the names that came into my head, and I didn't know why they were going on. I don't need to know why. I need to know that I'm connected with my power greater than myself, and the name needs to go down. So the first week, I write the names. And then after that, what I do is I write the first and second column. So Dan doesn't make the bed in the morning if he gets up after me is on every single inventory I've ever written. And it never gets better. Dan, you know, didn't pay the mortgage on time. Dan, you know, Ben rolls his eyes at me because I reminded him to take a shower after he asked me to remind him to take a shower. Right? Kids are awesome.
And here you can see by doing that process, it's, you know, this is where you've let God in and you're not deciding like what is important and what isn't important. You are just letting it flow.
Yeah. So after I have those first two columns, I try to get those two done as quickly as possible because let me be very super clear here. If you sit on inventory, it will start to leak out
everywhere.
Everyone around you will annoy you. Everyone on the road will be a jerk. No one will yield outside of the circle or inside of the circle. And you will your blood pressure will literally go up in general. You will start to damage the relationships in your life. You will start to sabotage your marriage. You will start to sabotage your job. I really wish I was being funny, but I'm not. I've seen it. I've seen people go out and drink because they sat on the inventory and just refused to just finish it. I think it was Dave Palmer that said at one point, or maybe it was Chris that said, any good inventory is really about 4 hours of actual writing. Whether you do it 1 hour a day for 4 days, or you do it 15 minutes a day, or you wait 6 months in between writing, any pretty solid except for your first insane one with 300 resentments. Thanks, Heather. we'll take about 4 hours. Care enough about what you already have to just get it done, even if it's crap. I would rather a sponsee show up with crap than sit on it for a year and sabotage the things that God has given them. So I write the first two columns as quickly as I possibly can. And when it comes to bitching, dude, once I start, it's really easy. I'm sure no one can relate to that. Mm-hmm. But then what I do is I do each resentment across. So you've got person, resentment, then it affects my. And you've got, help me get all of them, self-esteem, mm-hmm. which is how I see myself. Pride, which is how other people see me. Pocketbook. Mm-hmm. Personal relations, mm-hmm. sex relations. Aren't there seven?
Security.
Mm-hmm. Financial. That's pocketbook. Ambition. We got all seven. I've only been doing this for like 28 years.
Nice.
So, and in the inventory I write is you actually have to write out how it affects those things.
Yeah, not the check marks, the little just words.
But I want to revisit the pride and the self-esteem because it's the number one confusing thing for everybody, including myself. I always want to think that it's my self-esteem that's damaged. But I've been had it drilled into my head by my sponsor, every single sponsor I've ever had, that apparently I have really great self-esteem and my pride is out of control. So let's say I go to Starbucks, and my Starbucks isn't ready, right? Yeah, because that's happened to all of us in Westfield. Just saying, it's the B team. Anyway, so we walk in, and I think I'm better than everybody else because they're the slackers who don't have the app, and they're all waiting in line. Just being honest. And I walk over smugly, over to where the pre-order pickup place is, and you know, you try not to touch anybody's cup of coffee, but you're kind of trying to twist, you know, see my name, and my name's not there.
Breathing loudly.
And the facial expression. And so now I immediately feel what I think is ashamed because my coffee's not there. And don't they know who I am? That's my freaking coffee. And then somebody, one of those slackers I was talking about, actually orders their coffee and gets their coffee before me. And I'm still standing there like, not the plan. Now, in my inventory, I'm mad at Starbucks for not doing what I want them to do, which is have my coffee on tap all the time. And it affects my, sometimes I'll think it's my self-esteem because I feel X, Y, and Z. But the reality is I think other people see me as X, Y, and Z. Whether they see me as a snob who didn't get her coffee fast enough and they're laughing at me, that's my pride. Or they feel sorry for me because that's what I try to do to everybody, make you feel sorry for me. And that poor girl doesn't have her coffee. Those are not self-esteem issues. Those are my pride. Self-esteem is I initiated intimate time with my husband and he rejected me. And that could go both ways. He thinks I'm fat is my pride. I think I'm fat is my self-esteem. I look in the mirror and repulse, right? Turn it around. My husband asked for intimate time with me and I rejected him because when I look in the mirror, I see a big fat pig. That's my self-esteem, right? How I see me is self. Remember self. How can an alcoholic forget self? Self-esteem.
There you go.
Only when it's convenient. Pride is how you see me. Okay. So then all the other ones are pretty pretty self-explanatory. If you have time and you have been through the work multiple times and you want to have a conversation about the deeper definitions of things like ambition, things like sex relation is not about intercourse. It's about how I react with the sex of the person that I have the resentment towards. So if it's I have resentment towards Susie, sex relations would be how do I deal with the female sex? It, you know what I mean? Like sex relations could be how, and then pride gets in there and self. You see how it all can get very deep? So the more time you have, if you want to have that conversation, I'd be more than happy to take an hour and sit and talk about the definitions of how deep this can go. The next column for us is selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking. Three different definitions because we're alcoholics. We like lots of flavor. Self-seeking is I do this so I can get that. It's conditional. I only do this so I never only, you know, I only do this so that I can get this. Self-centered is clearly it's all about me, not you, me. So on your inventory, it's self-centered is all about Beth. Just making sure you know that. And then selfish is queen baby. I want what I want. I want it now. I can't believe my coffee's not freaking ready, even though I just ordered it in the parking lot. Then where was I frightened? Right? Where was I frightened? This for me is my toughest column. I run on fear. I have a shame-based personality, which I think I'm getting rid of. I really am proud of myself. I don't think I'm as shame-based as I used to be, but fear is a big trigger for me. Safety always comes first. Safety has to come before joy. So where was I afraid, right? So I have a resentment towards Starbucks for not having my coffee ready, right? We follow it all the way through to where was I afraid. I'm afraid that my plans aren't being followed. I'm afraid I'm going to be late and get fired, right? Fear will always take me to the nth degree, right? Because I get there, and when I'm having a god-awful day, and God's nowhere to be found because I didn't tap in at all, that fear can literally go to, my coffee's not ready on time, I'm going to lose my job, Dan's going to divorce me, my kids are going to never talk to me again, and I'm going to be homeless, sober. And that's going to look awful. Pride. Do you see how it all encapsulates? Right. So after fear, where was I afraid? What were my character defects? And if you don't get them all, trust me, your sponsor will be more than happy to point them out. And how do I set these matters straight? Did I get all the columns? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's your resentment inventory. I don't ever give my girls a timeline. The way that I sponsor is, this is your deal. You do it. But if I start getting calls with the collateral damage around it, first words out of my mouth are, have you been writing inventory?
Mm-hmm.
How long have you been sitting on it? How long are you going to sit on it? I can't force any other human being, including myself, to have a relationship with their God. This is your life. This is your process, and I honor your process. How much pain do you really need to be in order to just take the damn pen and sit down? There are times where I've had girls come to me and be like, I can't do this and I don't want to be in pain anymore. Just come to my house. Come to my house. I'm not going to talk to you, but I'm not going to be nice to you. But you can sit at my kitchen table, and I guarantee you sit at my kitchen table, you've got nothing else around but to sit and write. I'll be in my sewing room making a mess.
Reiterate, you've asked God in. So one of the things I always suggest and works for me is anytime before I pick the pen up, I say a prayer. So anything that happens, it's going to be it's right where I'm supposed to be. And when I set the pen down, I say thank you. And it's all okay. And, you know, same thing that Beth's talking about, the same way I work with my sponsees is I don't say you have to have this done in a week or you have to have this done in a month.
Nope.
But if I see, we deal with a beast. Alcoholism is a beast. The disease that we have, cunning, baffling, powerful. So don't think that there aren't times going through the steps where you balk and you stop and it comes in and it tells you this is stupid and you don't need to do this and you know better, or, you know, Beth doesn't know what she's talking about and Karen doesn't make any sense. And, you know, that, I mean, those are the kind of things. And that's the stuff that when you're doing the work with somebody, you know, you want to address, well, you know, what is stopping you from doing it? Those are more the things instead of, it's not about, you know, finishing it in a certain timeline or those kind of things.
Yeah. Next, we move on to the fear inventory. So with the way that I do my inventories and the way that I do it with the girls, I can't sit and listen intentively for more than 2 hours. 2 hours is my cutoff. So what I do is I have them do the resentment inventory and we fifth step it. And it also works in favor because the fears come off the resentment inventory and go straight onto the fear inventory. Then we fifth step that. And then we do the sex and harms inventory and fifth step that. Most of the time, for people that have had time and have been through this process before, it's usually 2 hours each inventory will usually cover most of it. First inventories, it's like three sessions of resentment inventory. I'm like PTSD from all this.
It's
three sessions of fear inventory and like half a session of sex and harms because we're not ready to talk about it yet. So next we move into the fear inventory, right? Because I know for myself, fear does everything. Fear triggers everything that I've done and will do, which is why I feel so compelled to maintain my connection with my God, because I will literally sit not even on the entire sectional couch, but in that one corner spot in the center of it and watch shows for days. Because I'm petrified. I'm petrified of people. I'm petrified of the world. I'm petrified of the air. I'm petrified in my loveliness. So when I have the only time, and I'm in marketing, which I don't even know how that happened. Like I talk to people all freaking day long. Don't ask me why. But if I don't have God, and when I go dark, I don't hit the road as much. I cannot. I do not have the needed power to go and do my job. So then we have the fear, right? It's bracketed. Mrs. Jones and the employer. I love those really funny t-shirts. What does it say? Mr. Jones is a dick or something?
It's Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown, yeah.
It's a dick.
Mr. Brown's a dick.
I think it's Mr. Brown needs to get his ass kicked.
Yeah!
I didn't see that. Oh, that is so
the
good.
Best shirt ever.
That's good.
I'm
that's
definitely
good.
Getting one of those. Yeah, maybe I'll make it.
That's good.
It's just another reason to lock myself in my sewing room by myself. It's an evil and corroding thread. the short word somehow touches every aspect of her life, right? Corroding thread. Think of it this way. You ever see plaid? Think plaid that's woven, right? There's usually in each plaid, there's like one really thin stripe that goes like intertwined with the major colors. Like think like Scottish. I just learned this word today. Damn it. They're pattern, right? They have. Yeah.
Ooh,
who said that? This looks super impressive, man. Wow. He's smart. But think of that one thin color that goes through as part of the pattern as fear. If you try to take it out, right, think about the physical fabric. Think about trying to pull fabric, one thin stripe of yarn out of the fabric. The fabric falls apart.
Right.
We could not, without God, live without that fear shot through the fabric of our lives. Every delusional lie that we continue to live through is based on those lies. And if we were someone who were to just rip them out, our world would literally come crumbling down around us. So this is how hard. Like, I know it's not a big deal. It's just a fear inventory. But, like, for real, go to your core. And if somebody were to just rip out all those fears, your whole life, I'm talking about the first time you go through the work, your whole life is just riddled with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have been able to not commit suicide if that had happened. So again, going back to the let's not judge ourselves and beat ourselves with clubs, every inventory we come into, let's dig in a little bit further, lean in a little bit further, and try to take some more of those lies and those fears out. So it says, it was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve, right? Self-pity. But did we not ourselves start the ball rolling? And what that means is, didn't I, ask yourself, did I begin to live my life by a delusional lie I created in my mind and then started literally making life decisions based on it for years? Okay, everybody's on board. We think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. And when you look at fear like that, it makes perfect sense. We reviewed,
thank you,
our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us, right? So my dad died, and I'm okay. It was a long time ago. And when my dad died, unbeknownst to my conscious brain, I took my will back in my marriage because my husband was the only man now in my life. And if God was going to take my dad, what was going to keep him from taking my husband? Completely delusional, irrational fear. So what I decided to do was become completely agnostic in my relationship with my husband. I started that ball rolling. 4.5-5 years later, we almost got a divorce. I choked the ever-loving guts out of my marriage. Controlled it, managed it, pushed it, pulled it, formed it. My husband was suffocating. I would have wanted out too. Of course, I was all like, what?
Look how hard I've been trying.
Yeah! Mm-hmm. Your life is so beautiful! He's like, I'm purple and choking.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us had a great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. And when it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there is a better way to think, for we are now on a different basis, a basis of trusting and relying upon God. Take away the agnosticism and put what you love most back in God's hands and abandon it there. We trust an infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do this, He would have us humble. He would have us and humbly rely on Him. Did I just say that right? just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? Now, this started to me to sound really authoritative, that God was going to be my director and I was going to have to do what he said, until my sponsor backed me up and reminded me, God only wants one thing for us. And does anybody here know what it is? It says it in the book. God only wants one thing for us, and that's to be happy, joyous, and free. It's the only time that the book tells us that God actually wants something for us. It's to be happy, joyous, and free. So me, being a delusional liar who is steeped in fear, if I abandon myself to him, he will know what will truly bring me happiness and put those opportunities in my life. I wanted nothing more than to be in a happy marriage with a man that could support an incredibly frustrating, strong woman. And Dan showed up. Mm-hmm. I wanted nothing more than to raise children that were basically raising themselves. And so Ben showed up. And then something got mixed up and Morgan showed up. We're not quite sure. I don't know. I literally was at a conference on Long Island, and the lady was like, the universe, God, is waiting to respond to you, and just tell the universe what you want. And I'm like, I hate my freaking job, and I can't believe I have to be here. And fine, you want to know what I want? And I went into this like 20-minute meditation where I was like, I want to work close to home. I want to work with ethical people. I want a great boss. I want a great team. I want great staff. I want a good car. I want this. Blah, blah, blah. 3 days later, I got a job offer. 4 miles from my house. I will never leave this company. Just saying. I just had my review and my boss goes, so where do you see yourself in 5 years? I'm like, right here.
No, what do you mean?
She goes, you did so well this year. She goes, you really, you know, you can go anywhere you want in the umbrella company, and we're just, everybody just loves you to death. And I go, okay, but can I stay here? And she's like, I go, that petrifies me when you say that. And she goes, why? I'm like, you don't know me. I just stay here. So we have this, right? We rely on him. He enables us to match calamity with serenity. I love difficult situations. I love chaos, because now that I'm in the place where I'm at, I can do what the St. Francis prayer says. Just show up. And God gives me anything out of that prayer that's necessary for me to respond, instead of bring more confusion rather than harmony. I've been flipped into a place where I get to bring harmony if I shut my mouth, usually. But I just show up and allow people the space to experience what they're experiencing. And basically, like that show New Amsterdam, how can I help?
And I used to think showing up meant I had to fix everybody, and I had to have the answers, and I had to have the solutions. And that was me running on self-will and playing God. And, you know, if you just show up and just be, I mean, that's about being authentic, about being vulnerable. And that's what people relate to. Mm-hmm. Not what knowledge you have, not background, not degree, just to be.
Just you.
And be present. Yeah.
My experience is that there's a light in every single human being on this earth. And when we start to buy into the theory that light begets light, mm-hmm. and that no one can steal your light, but you can create light in others, when we start to realize that my light's not going to go out and that nobody can steal it, we start to let that light grow. And we start to go into our lives with openness. We start to walk into situations wanting to be of service, because there's nothing more beautiful than taking your candle and giving it to somebody else. You've just doubled the light. And then, if you're lucky enough to stick around these rooms, you will often get to see that person give their light to somebody else. That's what our experience equates to. It equates to freedom. It equates to joy, a life of purpose, a life of all of these things. I'm totally getting ahead of us. I feel like we're in step 12.
A life of service.
I know, right? I'm all about the joy. And I also hate inventory, so maybe that's where that came from. But anyway, real quick before we run out of time, Sex and Harms is the same exact inventory. And on page 69, how funny is that?
Yeah, I know.
There's
way
no
back
way
then.
They
I know.
That.
Yeah,
did they even do 69 back then?
Yeah, they just didn't have a name for
but
it.
But did they call it 69?
No. Well, like, how do I know? I don't know.
Karen, you were there.
I'm not that old.
I know you were there.
Oh, my God.
She's like 40. I don't know. Anyway. Okay, so I have it written here, 9 questions. I don't know, somebody keep count. We'll see if there's 9 questions. On page 69, first full paragraph, we reviewed our conduct over years past. Where had we been selfish? Where had we been dishonest? Where had we been inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy? Suspicion or bitterness? Where were we at fault? Oh, what should we have done instead? There's 10. See, I don't even know what I'm talking about. We got this all down on paper and we listed it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. Remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised or loathed. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm by doing so. In other words, we treat sex just like everything else. In meditation, we ask that we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want. God alone can judge our sex lives. And this is like my least comfortable topic to talk about. We should bring Anne Marie to talk in about. Dude, she will. It will be like. I blush when she starts talking about the sex inventory. It's really funny. But anyway, here's the deal. The only thing I wanted to point out about this is there's 2 different things, inconsiderate or thoughtless. These are 2 really important distinctions for us to look at in inventory. Thoughtless means it was an innocent mistake. It didn't even cross my mind that that would hurt her feelings or his feelings. It never crossed my mind. It was completely thoughtless. Inconsiderate was I thought about it, and I did it anyway, because what I wanted was more important. Do you see how different they are? Do you see that there's 2 totally different motives here? There are 2 totally different things that we need to start really looking at inside of ourselves with those 2 things. It's a lot like that whole self-esteem pride. 2 totally different places, right? Only God can remove the pride. Only esteemable acts can relieve low self-esteem. You know, it didn't cross my mind just means that I'm small-minded and I don't have the capacity and I should probably start learning more about other people. Whereas inconsiderate is really callous. Is really like, yeah, I was pretty sure he didn't want to have sex, but I didn't want to care because I wanted to have sex. Yeah, I know he didn't want to get married, but I wanted to get married, so we got married. That's pretty bad. Mm-hmm. So those are the inventories. The only thing I'm going to point out here is a warning on page 70. I'm totally going over, I'm sorry. On page 70, first full paragraph, it says, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble, does this mean we're going to drink? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have an honest desire to let God take us to better things, we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we're not sorry, inconsiderate, and we continue to be inconsiderate, and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We're not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience, and I've watched this happen multiple times in the time that I've been sober. If you feel that welling up inside of you that you know you're not doing the right thing, that you know somebody could get hurt, even if you don't know them, I encourage you very strongly to either do a 10th step right away, or if it happened in the past, to get it down on paper, clear it out, because it will turn into a piece of rusted copper inside of you, and it will eat you alive. It's really scary. Please don't sit on stuff that comes up. Deal with it as it comes. Inventory is there for a reason. There's a million sober alcoholics here that would be more than happy to laugh at you in your fifth step. We can get through anything if we just take the steps to do it. Take a risk, lean in, have the conversation, ask the question, write the inventory, say the prayer, do something. Move a muscle, change a thought. I really never, ever want to be anything close to the dead human being that walked into these rooms begging for my life. I don't want to go back there. I really get everything. I get to do everything in my life. I get to fight with my husband about why the F didn't you pay the mortgage?
And make the bed.
And make the goddamn bed. So, that's it?
That's it.
Thanks for letting us share.
Thanks.